Are we doing a spooky intro to the podcast this week because it's Halloween?
Okay, yeah.
You do it because you've got a deeper voice than me.
Hello and welcome to a spooky wookie episode of The Europeans. Do you think that suffices?
Spooky wookie.
Spooky wookie, yes. Because it's Halloween.
It's Halloween and this is a podcast about a creepy old continent called Europe that is full of scary things like old buildings and bureaucracy.
Are you going to speak like this for the whole episode?
Yes, I am.
Honestly, I think it's not just Europe that's scary right now. I'm finding the whole world pretty terrifying and that Halloween is taking on a whole new meaning for me. But I have promised that we're not going to talk about He Who Must Not Be Named and the election that's taking place on the other side of the Atlantic next week. We've got more than enough European elections to talk about.
Yeah, well, there have been loads this week, haven't there? There's been Lithuania and Bulgaria, but we're going to be speaking about one in particular.
Yes, we're going to be talking about what I would argue is the most significant European election of the last week, the one in Georgia. An election that would decide whether the country moves towards the EU or towards Russia. The ruling pro-Russian party have claimed a win, but there have been protests since the election from the opposition, backed by the president of the country, who believe the country has fallen victim to a special Russian operation amid accusations that the election was stolen. That is the big, terrifying mess of an election that we're going to be diving into this week in our interview segment. We'll be joined later on in the show by the Georgian journalist and editor, Anna Gavarishvili. That's coming up later on in the show. But first, it's time for your primi piatti.
Delicious.
It's time for Good Week, Bad Week.
Good week, bad week.
Let's start with good week. Who's had a good week, Katie?
I'm going to call it an extremely heavily caveated good week for efforts to tax the super rich in France. And actually, if you want to talk about something truly scary this Halloween episode, I've got the perfect topic for you, French finances. I'm not sure how much the news of just how disastrous France's money situation is right now, like how much that's made headlines outside of France. Quite a bit, I think, right? Have you been able to follow it from over there in the Netherlands?
Honestly, it hasn't made many headlines. I only heard about it because I'm a Euro geek who listens to some other European podcasts. There do happen to be a few other podcasts about Europe. Yeah, I'm not sure how far it's cutting through, but it does sound pretty awful.
The very basic way to describe French politics right now is arguments about money. That is all that we're doing in Parliament all day, every day. There just isn't space or time for any kind of other politics. And that is because of the yawning gap between how much the government has been spending and how much it has been bringing in taxes. It turns out that the government kind of accidentally spent 50 billion euros more than expected. Ooh, over the past 2 years.
That's quite a boo-boo.
It is quite a boo-boo. And it's not really clear how it happened. There's actually a parliamentary inquiry underway to figure out who is really responsible for getting us into a mess quite this bad. I mean, on a basic level, it's kind of obvious what happened. So the government spent a ton of money during COVID, and then the economy hasn't bounced back as well as they would have hoped. So they haven't been bringing in as much in taxes as they'd like. But, you know, lots of European governments spent loads of money during COVID. And I don't want to make it sound like France is the only country that has been living beyond its means. But the particular combination of France being one of the biggest economies in the EU, its finances being in a terrible state, and as having an incredibly messy, dysfunctional government at the moment, that particular combination is making people really not want to lend us money right now because they're starting to doubt our ability to pay it back. So right now, France's international borrowing costs are higher than Greece or Spain, these countries that once upon a time had way higher borrowing costs. So let's just say the money situation in France is very not good.
I know France has like a really particularly messy political situation at the moment with this kind of cobbled together coalition of different parties. How is that playing into this difficult financial situation?
Yeah, so quick recap. As you may recall, we had parliamentary elections in France back in July, and everyone at the time was really worried about Marine Le Pen's far-right party winning those elections. They actually came in third in the end because voters rallied against them and did loads of tactical voting. And to everyone's surprise, the left came top. So there was loads of celebration on the left. They were all like, yay, after all of this, we're actually going to have a left-leaning government. That is not what happened, though. Macron refused to appoint a left-wing prime minister. And he did that at least in part because actually the three main blocs in parliament, the left, the mainstream right, and the far right, were all pretty close together in numbers, even if the left was a little bit ahead. And Macron argued that a left-wing prime minister would be instantly voted out by the other two-thirds of parliament, which is almost definitely true. But it did mean that Macron ended up appointing a right-wing minority government propped up unofficially by the far right. And that was seen as a huge disappointment by the left and a betrayal, really, of this vote that they'd come top in, even if they hadn't won a majority. So that's the political context. We have this weak right-wing minority government in a parliament where the biggest bloc, the left, is super mad at it. And the far right kind of has the government by the balls and can force them into loads of concessions to win their votes. So this is a horrible situation in which no one would want to actually govern. As his prime minister, Macron hires the one person who he thinks might be able to hold a government together in these circumstances, and that is Michel Barnier, who you might remember as the guy who led the Brexit negotiations on the EU side.
Mm-hmm.
And Barnier's first job is to put together a budget for next year. Not a normal kind of budget where there are like, you know, mild tweaks to the taxes on things like cigarettes, but a budget where he has to somehow find savings worth tens of billions of euros. Would you want this job?
No. I mean, that's going to be a horrible job for whoever has that position. Maybe the left have actually come out of this well by not having to make those awful decisions.
I think they've dodged a bullet, yeah. I mean, they absolutely didn't want to make any spending cuts. So we don't even know what situation we'd be in right now, but I don't suspect it would be any better, even though, like a lot of people, I was quite mad with how these elections turned out. Anyway, so Barnier gets to work. He puts together a budget where he is trying to save 60 billion euros in just 1 year, 40 billion of which are going to be spending cuts, and the other 20 billion of which are going to be increased taxes.
Wow, so it really sounds like a new era of austerity.
Yes and no. Barnier's not an idiot, and he knows that French people are very good at protesting. Mm-hmm. They'll protest about ketchup, as one newsletter very charmingly put it. So he's had to be very careful about the cuts that he's proposed. And a lot of the cuts will affect ordinary people. That's very clear. They are ending this energy cap, which did quite a lot to shield people from big rises in energy costs in recent years. Pensions aren't going to go up in line with inflation for a while. 4,000 teachers' jobs are going to be scrapped.
Ooh.
Local authorities are somehow going to have to find 5 billion euros in savings. All of these things disproportionately affect the less well-off who engage with public services a lot more than rich people. At the same time, when it comes to the tax increases, this right-wing government has been quite savvy about who it's targeted. So it's mostly going to affect big companies, the ones with more than 1 billion euros in revenues a year. Their taxes are going up. The state energy provider, EDF, is also having its bank account raided. They've been asked to hand over a bunch of money to the state after they made massive profits last year. And along with big companies, the top earners in France are going to have to take on more of the burden too. So the income tax is going to go up on the 65,000 richest people in France. They're also going to put new taxes on things like private jet flights. So there's some quite interesting policies here, given that this is a right-leaning government. Having said that, it's really difficult to find anyone in parliament who actually likes this budget, even within the government itself. The different parties that make up this fragile right-wing coalition are squabbling over whether there should be this many tax rises or whether there should be even deeper cuts. And we have been making our way very, very painfully through debates on the 3,500 amendments that were proposed to the budget by various members of parliament. I think there's something like 1,500 left that are supposedly still to be debated.
Oh my God.
It is exhausting. In the midst of all this, there are two amendments that got voted on last week that I wanted to flag up. This is quite in the weeds French political drama, by the way, but I'm hoping that it'll make everyone listening to this sound like experts to their friends when the French budget inevitably comes up when they're out for drinks with their friends. So stay with me. The first of these amendments was voted on Tuesday. I mentioned that in Barnier's budget, one of the plans is to increase the income tax on the richest French earners. So that's people who earn over 250,000 euros a year. That tax rise, like the other tax rises, is supposed to be temporary. This is, after all, a right-wing government, and it has been at pains to communicate to wealthy people, don't worry, yes, we're asking you to dig deep and help us out because the situation is really bad, but we promise this is just for 3 years, okay? It's temporary. What happened on Tuesday is that some of the more centrist MPs from the government itself actually rebelled and voted alongside the left to make this a permanent contribution that the richest earners have to make.
Ooh.
So that was quite entertaining to watch and quite a good indication of just how divided the government itself is right now. It is fighting itself along with everyone else. So that's amendment one. The other amendment is really interesting. This one was again proposed by the left, and to everyone's surprise, it passed on Friday, partly because a bunch of government MPs didn't show up to vote. And this is a tax on billionaires, specifically a 2% tax on the value of all of the assets held by French billionaires over the value of 1 billion euros. And again, the government was really pissed off that this had passed. They do not support this. They are worried that this kind of policy is going to scare off rich people from France in general. And in the end, the billionaires won't pay any taxes here because they'll just go and be tax residents in Switzerland or wherever. But it's also really interesting because there's been quite a lot of discussion globally about taxing billionaires and whether we could come up with some kind of global agreement on taxing them. Because as we all know, the problem with billionaires is that they're very good at moving their money around, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Brazil earlier this year was trying to get all of the G20 countries, 20 of the world's richest economies, it was trying to get them to agree on this. It didn't go so well, partly because, surprise, surprise, the US wasn't that keen on it. But the policy that was knocking around internationally was this proposal put forward by a French economist called Gabriel Zucman. And it is indeed a proposal to tax 2% of the wealth of the richest 3,000 people in the world. Not a tax on their income, because rich people always find ways of paying themselves that don't result in like a monthly paycheck landing in their bank account. It would be a tax on their wealth. So things like their property and their stocks, all that kind of stuff. And Zuckerman's argument for this is pretty simple. Billionaires pay way less tax as a percentage of what they have than ordinary working people because the rules let them do this.
Mm-hmm.
So the EU Tax Observatory estimates that the effective tax rate paid by billionaires globally is somewhere between 0 and 0.5%.
Wow.
Because they're so good at using like offshore companies and other clever tricks to make themselves look poor in front of the tax man. So the argument is, if we change the rules to make it harder to just wriggle out of paying them, even a 2% tax on their wealth would raise $250 billion a year.
Whoa.
Which we could use for all kinds of things, fighting poverty, addressing climate change, you name it. And this is the amendment that got passed in France on Friday, a 2% tax on the assets of billionaires.
But isn't this a lifesaver for Barnier and his budget problems?
Well, very sadly, I'm here to burst your bubble because it seems quite unlikely that this policy is going to survive the final vote on the budget in the Senate.
Oh.
I mean, you might argue that, yes, it could potentially raise a lot of money, but in a situation where other countries aren't doing it, there is maybe something to the government's fear that, like, if you bring in this kind of policy, it would just cause billionaires to become tax resident elsewhere.
Mm.
They're that selfish that 2% just feels like too much to pay, apparently. It also wasn't clear anyway from the amendment how it would actually work, like how you would calculate the value of this wealth that the billionaires hold. Like, are you going to ask them to get their houses revalued every year to work out how much they're worth? The same for things like paintings that they own?
Well, I mean, in the Netherlands, we have to get our houses revalued often and pay tax in.
Really?
Just normal people do, yeah. So it doesn't sound like such an extreme thing that a few billionaires will have to do, honestly.
Well, these are the arguments of Gabriel Zucman as well, that this thing would be very workable. Not necessarily tomorrow, but certainly sometime in the near to midterm future. We can dream. Anyway, the lack of detail in the French proposal doesn't really matter because, like I say, sadly, this thing probably isn't going to make it into the final budget. And at the time of recording, it's not clear that the other amendment is going to make it in either, because the government is so pissed off about all of these amendments and so exhausted that it is thinking about just pushing its preferred version of the budget through without a vote in Parliament at all.
Oh.
After all of this debate, using a very controversial bit of the Constitution called Article 49.3. I think people will be really, really mad if they do that.
Yeah.
Because it would really feel like trampling on democracy by a government that a lot of people feel is not legitimate in the first place.
And surely then he's going to be at risk of having a vote of no confidence against his government.
Well, this is the question, yeah. And could he pass that vote? He has a minority government that is sort of really unofficially propped up by the far right. It's very unclear what could happen in those circumstances. A lot of people are saying we're just going to have new elections in France, probably next summer. I will keep you updated on that. But can we still call this a good week, even if these reforms don't make it into the French budget? I think we just about can, partly because, and this might be an unpopular opinion, I think this budget has probably more tax the rich elements than you might expect from a right-wing government. And I do also think it's quite a symbolic victory for the billionaire tax to have got this far and passed a first like parliamentary hurdle in France.
Mm-hmm.
And it helps feed into the global debate about this, even if it doesn't happen tomorrow. And who knows, I could be wrong. This could become French law in the coming weeks, in which case I think we could definitely look back at this week and say it was a really, really good week for trying to get the richest to pay their dues.
What a mess.
Yeah, that's French politics for you. Before I wrap up, a little podcast recommendation for you. Everyone on our team has been loving the two-part podcast release just a couple of weeks ago by one of our favorite shows, Search Engine. It is called Why Is It So Hard to Tax Billionaires? And it is extremely relevant to everything I've just told you.
Such good episodes.
They're getting really good on that show at explaining boring policies in a fun way. You should definitely check it out. Who has had a bad week, Dominic?
Well, it's been a bad week for anyone who uses a gas stove in their kitchen for cooking, because we're apparently more likely to die prematurely. Sorry to be the bearer of bad news.
It's a fun Halloween topic.
It is. Flames are killing us. We know this thanks to a new study published by some scientists at Jaume I University in Spain. They did a huge amount of research looking into the impact of exposure to indoor gas cooking in the EU and the UK, and discovered that across the EU and the UK, 40,000 people die prematurely each year in a way that's connected to their indoor gas cooking, which is just an extraordinary number of lives that are being cut short because of cooking with gas.
It really is. And we just don't ever talk about it. But it does also make me quite sad because I love cooking with gas.
Yeah, it's really not jolly. And I know gas cooking is one of those things that people feel really emotionally connected to. Do you still cook with gas?
I don't. But in my old flat, I had a gas cooker. And I have to say, for cooking Asian food, it's a lot better. But yeah, it's funny. Our entire team is like weirdly emotional about gas cookers. Our producer Wojciech, when he heard this, was like, no, like half of my childhood memories are cooking with my grandma with gas.
Yeah, it is. It is something that really people feel like they don't want to let go of. Actually, you say our entire team, but I'm actually someone who is really attached to my induction cooker, which I've had for the last few years. And I think it's actually really good. And I understand that if you're woking things, like Asian cooking, it's harder to reach those super high temperatures.
Yes.
But I find for almost everything else, I can adjust the temperature really precisely. My water boils extraordinarily quickly.
It's witchcraft. It doesn't seem natural. Don't trust it.
So, okay, I get the impression you maybe don't want to hear anything else about this bad week, but I think I am going to share some of the science behind it, okay?
Yeah, okay. Like, I'm going to have to leave my emotions behind. If this is dangerous, I guess I need to take my head out of the sand and hear about it. So why are gas cookers kidding us?
Yeah, well, this study was looking specifically at the effect of nitrogen dioxide, NO2 emissions from gas cooking on us humans. It builds on this study that was done last year that had mapped the amount of pollution found in different rooms in a home when there is a gas stove. So it's not just about emissions in the kitchen, but also in bedrooms and living rooms.
Mm.
They used that research and combined it with health effects already proven from exposure to NO2, and therefore could calculate these rather horrifying headline stats that 40,000 people die prematurely, using statistics they have about how many households still cook with gas in each country.
And so why is nitrogen dioxide bad? Like, what is it doing to my lungs or my body when I inhale it?
Nitrogen dioxide can cause and exacerbate respiratory conditions such as asthma, especially amongst children.
Oh, I have things like that. Damn.
So it's not just the premature deaths. This study estimates that around 1 million people across the EU and the UK have asthma that is associated with the presence of gas cooking appliances in their homes. They also calculate that the costs associated with the premature mortality and respiratory illnesses caused by these NO2 emissions in the house cost the EU and the UK a massive 180 billion euros combined. So, as you can imagine, they recommend that governments quickly implement policies to make it easier for people to change over to electric cooking systems. And look, it's not breaking news that nitrogen dioxide is bad for us, but it is the first time that a team of researchers have put numbers behind exactly how many people they think are dying due to these emissions and how many are getting sick. I should also mention that this study was only looking at the effects of nitrogen dioxide on people who live in households with gas cookers. And the scientists stress that it is probably actually worse than they're suggesting because they've not looked into the effects of the other emissions like carbon monoxide, fine particulate matter, or volatile organic compounds.
I'm curious, how many Europeans do actually still cook with gas? Is it still like most people? Is it half of us?
Well, the general stats I found seem to suggest that a bit more than a third of EU households still cook with gas.
Okay.
But it does vary hugely from country to country. According to the European Public Health Alliance, who have done a lot of research into this topic, countries like Sweden, Finland, Denmark, Bulgaria, and Greece have very, very few households still cooking with gas, whereas Italy, Romania, the Netherlands, and Slovakia all have a bit more than 60% of households cooking with gas, or at least did last year when this research I read was done. I think a lot of people think of pollution as being something that is outside of the home.
Yeah.
On busy roads, around airports and factories. But this study is like a pretty stark reminder that pollution within your home can be incredibly damaging to your health and the health of your children. This study is not an argument about what the use of gas is doing to the climate, but it's really about what it is doing to our own bodies and those of our families. But of course, whether or not people can convert away from gas cooking depends on their living situation. It's often way harder for people who are in rented accommodation to move away from gas. And it's often also very costly. So it depends on how your economic situation is, how much your national or local government are able to help you. If you can't change yet, if you're sitting at home thinking, I've got a gas cooker, what should I do? Ventilation is important. Open your window when cooking is what the experts say. And maybe also get yourself a really good mechanical ventilation cooking hood. And do not get a recirculation extraction hood like I have. I watched a video with a scientist who'd studied these recirculation cooking hoods. And the scientist said that they basically just move the emissions around the house, which makes sense.
Delicious wafts of NO2 just seeping around the house. Lovely.
But yeah, bad week for people who cook with gas cookers.
I mean, I guess, you know, if you have an electric cooker, it's also presumably, well, potentially better for the climate, right? Because at least here in France, there's a decent chance that my induction hob is fueled by renewables, whereas gas, maybe not that good. But I just really like, you know, like holding a bit of aubergine against it and grilling it directly. You can't do that on an induction cooker. And that's sad.
Yeah, it is sad. I think it's something we have to let go of and feel sad about until they find a way to create electric fires that aren't going to be damaging to us.
And that you can grill aubergines on.
And that you can grill aubergines on, yes.
If you are one of the extremely nice people who helps to fund this podcast via patreon.com, you'd have seen a post that our producer Wojciech put together recently, which explains what we've been doing with your money. And I have to say that when I saw it all written down, I felt really proud at how much we've been able to do this year thanks to our listeners. We have put out more than 30 podcasts, including a big investigative one looking at farming lobbies. We told a beautiful story about a farm in Hungary. We won a big prize for climate reporting. So I just want to say thank you again here on the podcast to everyone who makes all of that possible. And in particular, we want to say thank you to the latest amazing people who have dug into their pockets and helped us to fund the podcast via Patreon. They are Hannah, Billy, Zach, Douglas, Duncan, and also to Salvo and Anna for increasing their donations.
Thank you all so much. If you are in a position where you can't afford to become a Patreon supporter yet, or if you are already a Patreon supporter and want to make us love you even more, another thing you can do is rate us in your podcasting app so that other people are more likely to want to listen to us. This week, we're especially keen on ratings from people who listen via the podcast app Pocket Casts.
You use Pocket Cast, don't you?
I do. I actually think it's a very good podcast app. They are currently running a draw for podcasters who get their listeners to rate them on their app. So if you do that, we could be in the running for winning some free promotion from them, which would be very useful. We've got a link in our bio where you can see how you can rate us on Pocket Casts, or just head to the Europeans on the app if you've got it, or whatever app you're on, and give us those 5 juicy stars if you feel we deserve them.
Specifically juicy stars. That's what we want. The last time we talked about Georgia on this podcast was back in May, when these huge street protests had broken out in Tbilisi over a new law that was being brought in. This law looked a lot like a Russian law that was used by the Kremlin to shut down Russian rights groups and media outlets that were critical of it. And already at the time, this new law in Georgia felt like a strong signal that the governing party, Georgian Dream, was seeking to pull the country away from the path that it was previously on, this path of seeking closer ties with the European Union, potentially joining the EU, a path that a big majority of Georgians support, up to 80% of them, according to polls. In the run-up to the parliamentary election that took place over the weekend, it seemed clearer than ever that Georgian Dream, this party whose strings are pulled by an incredibly powerful billionaire, Birgina Ivanishvili, Georgian Dream is indeed abandoning that path of closer relations with the West. Last month, the government passed an anti-LGBTQ law that makes it illegal to promote, quote, the propaganda of same-sex relationships. It also spent a lot of the election campaign stoking fears of a war with Russia if the opposition won. Most chillingly, they pledged to ban opposition parties if they were re-elected. According to the official results, Georgian Dream won this election with 54% of the vote. But there are many indications that this is a vote that was neither free nor fair. And it's certainly a result that the opposition has rejected, along with thousands of protesters. So what happens now? And what does it feel like to be living in a country that is on the brink of becoming much, much less free, if you're somebody who's fiercely attached to freedom? I gave Anna Gavarishvili a call. Anna is a journalist. She's head of the Investigative Media Lab. And I gave her a ring at home in Tbilisi. So, Anna, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for inviting me and for dedicating this piece to Georgia. It means a lot.
We're very happy to have you here with us. You were out on the streets of Tbilisi last night. What was it like? Can you describe the atmosphere and what you saw?
Well, to me, it felt like not only the yesterday's protest, but the recent days, it felt like it's a funeral. Everyone is quiet, calm, kind of depressed. People are angry, but at the same time, they are confused. Of course, they still keep fighting because it's their country. And no matter how disappointed you are or how depressed you feel, you still have to get up, go there and fight back, because like it's either that or just giving up to the Kremlin. So people still keep fighting, but they don't represent that feeling of resistance we've seen during the last months, because they're still trying to process everything that happened on the night of October 26th.
How sure can we be that these elections were not free and fair? What is the concrete evidence?
There have been many evidences and proofs shared by local observers who claim that the elections were totally rigged and frauded by the government. But to me personally, the best evidence of it is the exit poll shared by the Edison Research, which is the independent organization. I'm saying this because Edison Research has this history of always releasing exit polls that is aligned with the actual results of the Central Election Commission. In 2021, in 2018, in 2016, the margin of error used to be like 3, maximum 4%. And now it's like 20% difference between Edison Research's exit poll and official results. So that is like the main question. How could Edison Research do all those exit polls all these years so good and so precisely? And how they managed to fail this much this time in these elections when all the local observer groups are stating that the elections were fully rigged and taken away. Other than that, the elections in Georgia are being rigged before the elections.
How do you rig an election before it happens?
So there are many ways. The most popular is the bribery of the voters. And this is applied especially for those who either work for government agencies, like civil servants, and people who live in rural areas and are poor, live in poverty, and are receiving state aid. Those people are being manipulated and intimidated into thinking that Georgian Dream knows who they will vote for. And if it's not them, then there would be consequences. For example, they will stop the social aid, they will lose their jobs, and et cetera, and et cetera. And especially in these elections, this was highly used because this was the first time Georgia used electronic devices in the elections, which creates an atmosphere of trust issues, because when there is electronic machines involved and there is this unique QR code on their ballot, so they got super afraid of that, and Georgian Dream used it widely, and opposition parties and observers reported on cases like that before the elections. Tactic-wise, I don't think that there is like anything new we've seen in these elections, but the scale we are talking about is huge. We are talking about 15%, at least 15% of frauding here.
But if you take out the people who were intimidated, the people who were paid, there are still some people who genuinely support this party, right? Who are those people? Can you tell me a bit about them? Why would they be favoring this party that wants to take the country closer to Russia?
We need to understand that Georgia is a post-totalitarian country, is a post-totalitarian society with only 3.5 million population, with a neighbor like Russia. It's always scary when you look on the world map and like seeing this huge monster on the north part of Georgia. That neighbor did everything in this country in terms of hybrid warfare to create different narratives that could be believable by Georgians. And those narratives include that fear of war that was widely used in these elections by Georgian Dream. I honestly can't blame people who truly voted for Georgian Dream because they were afraid of war. I mean, I can understand where is that coming from, because Georgia is still bleeding from this tragic wars it endured. You know, the brief history of Georgia for the last 200 years goes like this. In 1801, Russia annexed and occupied Georgian kingdom for 108 years. Then we declared independence in 1918. In 1921, we were occupied again by the Soviet Russia this time and spent 70 years under Soviet Union, under totalitarian regime. And then we declared independence again, and we paid by blood for that. And then we had civil war in Tbilisi that was triggered by Russia. We had war of Abkhazia in 1992-1993, not only triggered, but we literally were fighting Russia in that war. And we've lost Abkhazia in that war. And then after that, we had revolution in 2003. Again, we had war with Russia in 2008, and we've lost control over Samochablo region. So this is the society we're talking about. So I don't like when people judge these people who genuinely voted for Georgian Dream, because it's understandable. We're talking about very fragile, very vulnerable group of people, and those people are also our citizens, citizens of Georgia. Those people also need to have better future in the European Union. Maybe they don't understand that this right now, maybe they don't trust the process right now, but I'm sure they will be thankful that it happened to them.
This election has been described by some as a special Russian operation. Why is it important to Putin to keep Georgia under Russia's influence? What is the strategic game that is being played here?
Georgia is a strategic country, and Georgia has a strategic location in the Caucasus region. Putin understands that losing Georgia won't just end with Georgia. We see Armenia getting closer with the European Union. There is Moldova. There is, of course, Ukraine that is pinged by blood not to be under Russian influence again. We're not talking just about Georgia. I don't believe that Georgia has a special place in his heart or mind or something like that. It's just part of his imperialistic mindset. They still are keen on the idea of creating something like modern Soviet Union, when all these countries that finally managed to get out of the Soviet Union and get out of the Russian shed goes back to them. And maybe it's not an organization, but we are still together, and Russia declares this part of the world as its own.
Western officials have been quite cautious about how they've responded to all of this so far. So far, they've stopped short of calling this a stolen election. People like Ursula von der Leyen have said things like the irregularities need to be investigated, but they're not saying, you know, we do not recognize the results of these elections. What do you make of that reaction from the EU and other Western governments like the US?
So first of all, there are still people in the West who are not afraid to not hesitate to say what it really was. For example, Viola von Kramon, who declared the elections as illegitimate. And there are like other countries who had personal conversations with President Zurabishvili and showed their immense support. I agree that statements from OSCE, even from Secretary Blinken's representative, it was weak, I would say, and kind of hesitating. And yes, it was disappointing, but it doesn't mean that Georgians should not keep fighting, because at the end of the day, it's our country and we have to deal with our own problems. So we should not expect Western leaders to do our own job. I think if we just keep fighting and keep providing and gathering all the data that will prove that elections were poorly and totally and completely rigged and frauded, then even those Western leaders will have to be stronger with their statements. So that's the only way it goes.
In terms of what happens next, Georgia's opposition are pretty fragmented. They managed to form a united front for this election, but that unity was mostly built around skepticism of the direction that Georgian Dream seemed to be taking the country in. Is there anything they can do now?
Opposition is pretty weak in Georgia and fragile. They don't have trust of people, and that also played the role in the elections and the results we've received. In 2020, they also claimed that elections were rigged and frauded, and they declared boycotting the parliament. They declared that they would not enter the parliament. There were protests. Boycotting is one thing. it will just help international stance that the parliament is not legitimate because it's only presented by the Georgian Dream Party. And that's good. I'm not saying that it's not a good idea, but it's just not enough. I think the best way to go for Georgians right now is a way to do many things altogether. So, for example, endless and continuous protests in the streets, massive protests. I'm talking about hundreds of thousands of Georgians.
I just had one final question for you, Anna, and I'm sorry, it's a quite depressing one. You are speaking to me from a country where the ruling party had promised before the elections to abolish the opposition parties if it won. You are a journalist in this country, a critical journalist. What does that feel like?
I have mixed feelings about that. At one point, it feels like that I want to just turn off all my feelings toward Georgia and just go abroad and live my life and take my daughter to a better country and to give her better life than I ever had in Georgia. But on the other hand, it makes me so angry, so furious that my country will be taken away from me, that my daughter will have to live all her life under the label of immigrant because some morons decided to take this country back into the Kremlin, that it only makes me want to fight more and fight more harshly and to do more against them. I hope that I will keep this spirit, but I would not be honest if I would say that, no, I don't think like leaving this country and I'm like staying here forever and doing this forever, because emotional resources, physical resources, intellectual resources, at some point you might just realize that you can't do this anymore. And that was the feeling I had on the night of October 26th. And then on October 27th, I felt like I declared defeat to the authoritarian regime because I just can't enter this process again where we go out and we have this hope that we're in the middle of the pivotal moment only to do the same thing again in a month. So I was really frustrated. But then I went to the rally yesterday. I've seen the people feeling exactly like me. I could tell that they were also super frustrated and nihilistic and still were standing there. And that caused a little bit glimpses of hope in me again that maybe if we don't get tired, we'll take this country from the hands of the Kremlin.
I have to say that I had to hold back tears at some points during that conversation. I'm really grateful to Anna for sharing her thoughts with us at an incredibly difficult time. Before we hit record, she mentioned that she was really moved, actually, that a podcast called The Europeans would be covering what's happening in Georgia. That's not going to be changing. We have covered Georgia before in this podcast. We will continue to do that. For us, Georgia is a part of Europe. Anna is a great person to follow on Twitter if you're looking for updates on Georgian politics. Apparently that website is still useful for something. You can find her at Anna Gavarishvili. It is a special spooky edition of the Inspiration Station. Neither Dominic or me particularly enjoys scary stuff, so we had to crowdsource these. But we asked our Patreon supporters in the Facebook group if they had any spooky European recommendations for you. And we've got a couple to share with you. Who's your one from, Dominic?
Yeah, I wanted to talk about a food item that listener Francesca in Italy wrote in to tell us about. She says that in Italy, there's still not so much like Halloween-y trick-or-treating, just a few private parties. But it's also All Saints and All Souls Day over the next few days, which is kind of connected.
Yeah.
And during this period, they have a typical biscuit that they bake. It's called Fave dei Morti, basically fava beans of the dead. And the cookies are not actually made of beans. They're Armady biscuits sprinkled with sugar, and they look absolutely delicious. And they're made to look like fava beans or broad beans, which are traditionally a symbol of the dead in Italy. Back in ancient Rome, fava beans were actually thought to contain the souls of the dead.
What happened when you ate them then?
You didn't. You put them like on the grave, actually.
Oh.
Yeah, they used to throw the beans on graves, and I think still do in some places.
Interesting.
Anyway, I'm going to bake some of these deathly biscuits over the next few days. I cannot wait. And I'll put a recipe in the show notes.
Sounds great.
What spooky recommendation are you bringing to the table today?
So my recommendation is from Amalia, and she's got a video game recommendation for you. I love this. We don't do enough game recommendations. This is a horror video game called Mundown. It is from Switzerland, and it takes place in a real place in the Alps called Mundown. And you are playing a character who is returning there for their grandfather's funeral, except when he gets there, the grave is empty.
Ooh.
So it's a mystery. You're trying to find out what happened to this character's grandfather. And I have to say, it looks very spooky indeed. Even just Googling it, you see the graphics and there's something very haunting about them. But it's quite incredible reviews, this game. 9 out of 10 on Steam. Amalia says, the game is inspired by traditional folklore imagery and stories. And all the dialogue is spoken in a regional dialect called Romansh, which gives it a very unique identity. I found the experience more atmospheric and dreamlike than horror, with some very creative imagery. So if you're a gamer and you like a good mystery, check it out.
For my happy ending this week, I want to discuss a policy that was announced in Norway this week that made me happy. The Norwegian Prime Minister Jonas Gahr Støre announced that he wants to ban access to social media to children under 15.
Ooh, I'm not sure the 14-year-olds will be as happy as you about this.
Exactly, yeah. I'm not sure this is really what I should be using a happy ending segment for. It's more suited to stories of grandma discovering a piece of art on her wall that she bought in a thrift store and is worth €1 million.
Yeah.
But honestly, this announcement in Norway was the news story that made me happiest this week. So that's why I'm talking about it. And it's because I'm more and more convinced that social media is not good for society in so many ways, be it worsening polarization, the spread of misinformation, the incitement of violence, but also the well-documented negative effects it can have on our cognitive development, our mental health, our self-image. And I think it's particularly potentially dangerous and damaging for children. I know I'm going to sound like such a millennial right now, but I am really pleased I didn't grow up with social media as a child. I think I would have been more anxious, less happy, and would have just spent less time outside in the real world.
Yeah.
And to hear that the Norwegian government want to bring in this ban, I think personally is happy news.
We're going to get so many emails from cross Norwegian 14-year-olds about this.
Norway already actually has a ban for under 13s, but the plan is to raise it to under 15s. And apparently the current law is not really being enforced and loads of kids under 13 are still using it. So the idea is to try and strengthen that law. And yeah, you might remember on this show a while ago, we talked about the new Swedish guidelines for screen time for kids. Mm-hmm. That also had some impressive ideas, but I think this Norwegian policy is even more radical in a way because it's really taking on the social media giants head on, something that many world leaders these days seem a bit too scared to do. So yeah, a little bright spot in the distance in this gloomy social media time.
Given your habit of US election doom scrolling at the moment, do you think you should maybe enforce a Norway-style teenage ban on yourself, Dominic?
Honestly, I'm trying. Me and one of my friends are trying to limit ourselves to one Kamala hour a day.
An hour?
And we like check up on each other. Like, have you done your Kamala hour already? And then sometimes he'll send me another link and I'll have to be like, hey, you've already done your Kamala hour today.
Put your phone away.
I know, I'm sorry.
That's all we have time for today, but you can find us if you're over the age of 15 and not in Norway, or if you're a Norwegian adult, on a range of social media platforms, can't you, Dominic?
Awkward transition. Yes, you can find us on Instagram at Europeans Podcast, on Twitter at Europeans Pod, and if you're lucky enough to be a Patreon member, then we have a nice, friendly Patreon group, which, yeah, it's the only place you need to be on Facebook, really.
And also Mastodon. I like it there. Come and hang out with me. Next week, we've got a really nice interview coming up about cinema, which feels like a welcome break from politics. Don't miss it. It will be in your feeds on Thursday, as always.
This episode was produced by Morgan Childs and Wojciech Oleksiak. Thank you both so much.
Thanks, guys. We'll see you next week.
What's a spooky goodbye?
Oh, salut. How's that? It's a French ghost.
Beautiful. Love it.